Fiction Uncovered, broadcasting live at Foyles in Charing Cross.
Okay, I'm Matt Thorne, and for the next half hour I'm going to be talking to David Baddiel about his book The Death of Eli Gold, and he's going to start us off with a reading from the book.
Yeah, I wasn't sure how long this reading was meant to be when I arrived here at Foyles, and so I had a really short bit because I thought it had to be really short, but now I've been told it needs to be slightly longer than that. So bear with me, but what I'm going to read is a bit... the book is about the death of a great writer, a sort of rather exaggerated mashup of all those great American writers who were either dying or dead at the end of the last century. Saul Bellow and John Updike and Philip Roth and Norman Mailer.
Philip Roth's not dying, is he?
he's old.
Right, okay.
So in that sense, we're all dying, yeah. Eli Gold is that guy in the book, and he's dying through most of the book, and he has... he's had five wives, I think, and as a result, a sort of huge fracture of family coming to sort of pay witness at his deathbed. And I guess the main character, although I don't know if I have a main character, but the one that probably bears most resemblance to a main character is called Harvey, who is the 44-year-old son of his third wife, who lives in London, has hardly ever seen him. That marriage ended when he was six. There's a lot of explanation for this bit, but... It'll all be worthwhile. Sure. He is very screwed up. And he sees a lot of his own psychosis and screw up as a result of his dad being a great man and him very much not being a great man, but also in terms of his dad having lived his life in a very, very masculine Norman Mailer kind of way, leaving women as soon as they got within 3 years of 40 and just having the license to do that kind of behaviour because in those days a great man was able to do it. And he himself is very much not that kind of man. He's kind of really a kind of new man, or at least grew up at a time when he was trained in being a new man. And then what he notices is that starts to come apart as his father starts to die, really. And so this is a scene which describes the first time he became very, very anxious about something which he feels he shouldn't feel, which is an anxiety about his beautiful wife starting to age. And he first notices it at Tower Bridge there with their son, who's got Asperger's and who has a very keen anxiety about when the bridge at Tower Bridge is going to open. I can't remember how long it's going to be, but that's important in this bit. And it begins with him remembering an incident when he was young with a cat. Okay, I think that's probably too much information for the reading, but here we go. Harvey loved the cat, who he called Luffer, a diminutive of Fluffy. Years later, he would discover this to be the name of a homeopathic nasal spray. His ability to love had spasticized with his parents' split, but not his reserves of it. The young Harvey was desperate for a receptacle to catch the overspill of love endlessly pouring from his heart, and that was Luffer. Harvey was transfixed by the tabby mongrel's deadpan feline beauty. He would look at her face for hours and silently beg her to grace his lap with her soft, warm form. He would come home from school tight with the small trauma of the day and run to wherever she was for release, sometimes burying his face in her fur. Every day for 3 years he would do this, until one day he saw her from their living room window sitting under a tree in the small communal garden behind their flat. He ran as excitedly towards her as ever, the run even more purposeful now that Luffer was getting old, until he got close enough to bend down and kiss her. But just then, before his lips made contact, across the side of her sleepy face crawled a large spider. Harvey was terrified of spiders. As a child, and indeed as a grown man, they flooded his body with horror, exploding his senses into a whiteout of fear and revulsion. If, for the pre-women worshipping Harvey, cats were beauty, then spiders were anti-beauty. He literally recoiled, like a spring had come out of Luffer's head, knocking him backwards about 4 foot onto the grass. Even as he fell, he knew immediately that he was scarred, if not physically, then psychologically, that here was a memory which would come back to him at some bad time in the future, death crawling over the face of love. So here it was, returning in middle age, the spider on Luffer's face. As he stared at his wife's altered features, a mixture of emotions coursed through him. Disbelief, uncertainty, profound existential terror. These coalesced into a form of intense psychic discomfort, as if a sadistic dwarf was scraping its fingernails down a blackboard in his soul. Stella, her empathy antennae immediately twitching, said, "What's the matter?" He looked at her. They had no secrets. She was his best friend. He had found what he had supposed to find, his soulmate, and the mating of their souls had happened without censorship. But here was something unsayable. She was his friend. He loved her, fiercely. How could he say words which would break that love in two? He couldn't, and not just to Stella. He saw in his imagination not just her face, but the faces of all the women he had ever known, and all the women he had learnt from when younger, and all the women who had written and were writing in all the books and all the newspapers about men and their shallowness and cruelty and objectifying and body fascism and misogyny. They seemed to crowd around his wife, challenging Harvey to tell the truth. He saw them, an infinity of women, arms folded, tapping their heelless shoes, drumming their unvarnished nails. He heard them chorus in unison, "Well?" And in amongst all the women, nodding and raising their eyebrows, he saw as well many men, men in glasses and suede jackets and well-cut hair, men who looked very like himself, carrying copies of The Guardian and The New Statesman, men who had accepted and internalised all the arguments about the dark truths of patriarchy and now held them as unblinkingly, if not more unblinkingly, as the women. It was a huge, right-thinking congregation, as unshallow as the river it stood beside. And then he saw their reaction should he offer the real answer, a wave of disgust, disappointment and outrage, passing all the way from Stella to the mass ranks watching on Tower Bridge, ready to open in 3 hours and 47 minutes, like all the legs in all the pornography, the watching of which had clearly led Harvey to this pretty pass.
Okay, you mentioned that your novel's concerned with the death of a great man of American letters, yeah. and made some mentioned some names there. I maybe would add Joseph Heller, maybe. I don't know if you would count him as well.
Yeah.
But do you think this is a loss to the literary world, the death of these great men?
Well, I think the book is an exploration of that to some extent, and I don't think it arrives, hopefully, I would rather it didn't, arrive at an absolute conclusion to that question. I think the book explores a notion that I have, which is that not just in literature, but also in politics, in science to some extent, in art, the time of the great man, specifically man, is kind of over. I think they were very, very big figures in the last century, you know, all the way from Picasso to JFK to whoever. And I think once sort of Nelson Mandela and maybe Philip Roth go, then that will be that. Because I think now both the possibility of greatness, sort of unalloyed greatness, which is where everyone just pays court to these figures, has gone, because to some extent the internet and the fraying of culture in general doesn't allow for that. And also I think the behaviour of them as men with a capital M is also no longer kind of viable. That licence to behave like Mailer did, sort of stabbing his fifth wife. And there's in this book, Eli Gold's fourth wife dies in a suicide pact with him that he doesn't die from. That is based on Arthur Koestler, whose wife did die in a suicide pact with him. But if you read Cynthia Koestler's suicide note, which is very different from Arthur's suicide note, she clearly didn't want to kill herself. But she was there at a time when that was what a wife of a great man would do. That's the extreme that was reached. So my point, I think, is that, you know, there's a very small bit in the book where there's a very fleeting reference to a bit in I forgot the name of it. Mike Myers' first films, what are they called?
Wayne's World.
Not the other one, sorry.
Austin Powers.
Austin Powers, thank you. In Austin Powers' first Austin Powers movie, there's a bit where one of Dr. Evil's henchmen dies. And then they cut to a bar, and a woman, who you don't know who is, gets a phone call, and it's the wife of the henchman, and she starts crying. And it's an incredibly moving moment, and in fact it's referred to briefly in the book. But what's key about that is Dr. Evil, for me, is a kind of great man. You know? And this cutting to the henchman's wife is sort of what the book is about, in that I kind of feel that history isn't, from now on, possibly, or certainly, we're at a time where smallness is going to be more important than greatness, or take its place more obviously in culture than greatness has, I think.
I was into the epigraph in your book, one of the epigraphs rather, is from David Foster Wallace reviewing Updike's Towards the End of Time. Did you use that epigraph before Foster Wallace had died, or afterwards?
Well, I was aware of it before he died, and it meant a lot to me, that particular epigraph. But I think I wrote, when did he die? 2008.
Yeah, I think so.
No, it would have been before he died, actually.
It
would have been before he died, but I wouldn't have changed it as a result of his death. In fact, his death is very important in a way, in that, you know, when Foster Wallace says in that epigraph, I'm not going to have to look at it to quote it exactly, but he says he persists in the bizarre adolescent idea that having sex with whomever you want, whenever you want, is the cure for ontological despair, by which he means just despair, yes. Really, for human despair. I think Foster Wallace, in that review of John Updike's Towards the End of Time in 1997, was announcing they are over.
Yeah.
These guys with their obsession with sex, you know, all of them, they're over, and I'm going to replace it with a kind of new mannishness, greatness.
Yeah.
But it's kind of important to me in a weird literary way, in terms of what I'm saying, that he died, because I think that you have to ask is that 10 years later, what cure for ontological despair did David Foster Wallace find?
Exactly.
And it might be the case that, although it was flawed in all sorts of ways, these great men's idea of what life is about and how to write about it, nothing else has quite been found for the male writer to replace them, perhaps.
I mean, it's very, because I mean, that Foster Wallace is usually a very generous critic, and that was one of the rare occasions where he really went for someone.
Completely.
I mean, it was a real kind of giant killing kind of exercise.
I think it was an announcement that he made just after Infinite Jest would have come out, actually.
Yeah.
That, you know, and Updike is an interesting one to go for. It's interesting that I don't think he would have gone for Bellow, who at the time would have been just too much of a sacred cow. But Updike has always existed, in my opinion, unfairly, somewhat behind Bellow. And also because of Updike's particular obsession with sex, I guess, it allows that. I think it's important. It allows for him to say, we live in a different political time, a different sexually political time, and you are therefore old-fashioned.
I mean, and if you look at another writer like, say, Nicholson Baker, with You and I, who's very much embracing that generation.
Yeah.
I was interested in how you feel, because a lot of your book columns and your criticism, you seem to be quite... You like Roth, I think.
Yeah,
and Bellow.
Do.
You like... So do you not feel... I mean, obviously...
I don't like Bellow.
You
actually
don't like Bellow? Okay,
no, I've written a couple of columns about how I feel guilty about not liking Bellow, although I sort of got over the guilt and then started to come out about just saying, no, I just don't like him and it's okay.
But, I mean, obviously for Foster Wallace, there was this need to kill off the generation. Do you feel any of that with the older generation of writers?
No, I think as an English writer, you don't... I don't know what you think, but I don't know if you do anyway, because I don't think we have them sitting on our shoulders in quite the same way. I mean, there's Amos, and there's Ian McEwan and those guys, and they're great. But I don't know if they quite... Well, perhaps Amos does a little bit on the generation of writers that I guess we are.
Sure.
I think that, you know, Bellow and Roth and Updike and DeLillo to some extent, you know, they really do figure in the cultural pantheon in America in a way that I don't think any of our guys do. So I think, particularly for Foster Wallace, who I don't know exactly why he killed himself, obviously, and there's also pharmaceutical reasons for it, but Franzen says this thing about him, you know, that thing
he says,
where he says, I can't believe he's pulled that trick, i.e. killing yourself sort of makes you instantly into a legend.
Yeah.
And it seemed to me that Foster Wallace, perhaps, who was an incredible genius, you know, was sort of chasing that abstract notion of how to be that particular genius, and so therefore did need to kill the father in a very particular way, like he did with Updike. I don't feel that need to do that.
Okay.
And also, because I'm, you know, because an obvious thing, but because I'm didn't come at books in the normal way, because I was a comedian and still am a comedian and whatever, I guess it don't quite feel that urge in the way that someone who just writes might do.
But I mean, you have sort of projected yourself into that argument in a way with this character. What was the sort of impetus for doing that?
Well, the actual inspiration was actually the moment when Saul Bellow died, because I read all the reports and all the eulogies, and then I just became interested in the fact that most of them mentioned that his wife and daughter were at his bedside, and then I was just it was the daughter that I was interested in, because they talked about Bellow's age. They would say whatever he was, 80s, whatever he was, but they wouldn't mention her age. And I thought, well, she's 8, I think.
Sure.
And what's it like for her? What's it like not just being thrust so quickly into a death arena, but also a publicly death arena? And that's why it begins, My Famous Daddy is Dying, because that seems to encapsulate to me that particular experience, and also because on a wider scale that's about the death of a particular type of male. But that's how the inspiration was, that. And then I didn't really want to write a whole book from the point of view of an 8-year-old. I don't think I could do that or want to read it. So I then thought, okay, well, if Eli is one of these guys, he would have had 5 wives.
Sure.
So that allows me to see his death from different points of view.
You mentioned, you know, obviously some of the book there is narrated from the 8-year-old. You couldn't do the whole book, but that's part of the voices in there.
Yeah.
Was it hard to move between those voices, because there's more than one?
Yeah, there's 4, actually. I mean, there's her, Colette, who is eight or 9, I think. Well, I can't remember, 8. There's Harvey, who is 44. There's Eli's first wife, who owes a lot. I've been doing a few radio shows about Elizabeth Taylor recently, because it's her centenary this year, and I'm a big fan of Elizabeth Taylor's, and I read Mrs. Palfrey at the Claremont when I was trying to get my head round the idea of I had the idea of his first wife being an old lady in a care home, but I thought that's quite hard to write, and then I read Mrs. Palfrey at the Claremont and it was incredibly inspirational for me. So there's his first wife kind of watching on telly his public vigil over his death, and then this is an interesting thing from a writerly point of view. I was reading reviews of your book, actually, because I haven't read Cherry, but it sounds really interesting. And one of the things I noticed in the reviews of your book is it talks about it changing tack about sort of 50 or 60 pages in. And I only bring that up because when I was writing this book, the books I tend to really like reading, not that much happens in, like particularly Updike, people just have an affair and things go wrong.
Yeah.
But when I write, I don't know why this is, I find that I have to have some story motor that comes in at some point. And I was trying to not have that in this book, and then I got about 60 pages and I thought, no, I've got to have one. And so in a sense, the fourth character, which is the Mormon, who is the brother of the fourth wife who died in the suicide pact and who is kind of coming to New York to revenge that, that although I there are all sorts of other reasons why I wanted to bring him in, he represents a different type of American masculinity to Eli, and you know, he's a kind of also he's a kind of literary thing as well, which is I wanted to get that kind of Cormac McCarthy thing in a bit, but he's also just a way of creating a climax, so yeah, he's the other character. And in terms of answer to your question, no, actually, I felt I don't know why this was, but I liked the ability to be able to move away from character X when I'd done a big bit describing, you know, the situation, that I can move to another character. It felt refreshing.
It's interesting to say, one of the things I like about the book is the point at which that kind of narrative motor slows down slightly and allows for the description. There's lots of great description in the middle part of that book. At what point do you sort of need that narrative? Do you need that before you start writing, or does it come in during the process? How much narrative do you need to complete a novel?
Well, what I tend to do when I start writing a novel, and maybe a screenplay as well, I guess, but certainly a novel, is with this, it was that moment when I read about Saul Bellow dying and his daughter being at the bedside. So I thought, okay, I'm going to do it about the death of a great man, and it's not about the great man, actually. It's about the sort of damage he's wreaked in his life and how that affects the people around him who come to his deathbed. So that was the idea, and then I just start writing. And what I have kind of instinctive confidence in is that if I keep writing, a structure will emerge out of the fog. And that has happened. I've written four novels now, and luckily it has happened. It presumably could be the case I'd get halfway and it wouldn't emerge. But I do also, yeah, I try as much as possible to have lots of bits which aren't plot-driven. You know, I'm not interested in page-turning as such, but like to have a proper story going on in the books. I particularly like to have an ending that feels like an ending. I don't know why, but that just... that is what drives me to carry on writing to some extent, is I kind of want to know what's going to happen. But I don't start with it at all. I just hope it will emerge.
I mean, you mentioned earlier, obviously, you've had lots of success in other fields. I wonder what draws you to the novel as a form. I mean, because, it's less lucrative in some ways in other forms. It's harder, perhaps.
It is. It's really hard.
So what keeps bringing you back to it?
Well, a couple of things. One is... and I guess there are other comedians who might say this, but I kind of think I'm primarily a writer. I think that when I was younger, I didn't have it in me to write a novel at that point, but I was writing little stories and jokes or whatever, and the quickest way to get them out there was to go on stage at the Comedy Store and express that, and that is why I became a comedian. And the truth is, although... lots of people have complained about comedians writing novels, it's a kind of silly complaint, because most, you know, in 1979, when Alexis Sale first took the stage at Comedy Store, that was the point at which writers and comedians kind of merged anyway, because they were no longer northern blokes just telling old jokes. They were people talking about their lives and writing stories, just expressing them out loud. So I don't think that gap was necessarily there. What draws me to it is I do like story in a bigger and longer and deeper form than you can do certainly in stand-up. And in terms of, as opposed to writing film or whatever, which I've done, is I like language. I think that in film you have to keep your tabs, make sure that the language is tamped down quite a lot. Otherwise, it starts to get very kind of overwritten and dense and flowery. Whereas I like that in a novel. In fact, I personally, if I pick up the back of a novel and it says, like it often says these days, written in a spare, stark prose, as if that's a good thing, I don't buy it. I kind of like writing to be writing, and to pick up a sentence like, I mean, Updike is the key for me. It's if I read, Martin Amis said this thing about John Updike, he says that all writers have their sort of 10 or 15 similes that they're going to, killer similes and metaphor, that they're going to sprinkle throughout the book, and you read a page of John Updike and he's got 20 on one page and you get suspicious. You can't, but that's my kind of gold standard for what writing in a novel should be.
So, I mean, how do you achieve that density of prose given all the other things you're doing? Do you stop everything when you write a novel, or are you doing that long?
I don't, and I should do, I think. I think probably the novels would be better if I did that, but I can't. I mean, I could, but I find like an anxiety if I do that. I just like every day going in and just writing, I find that really actually genuinely anxiety creating.
Sure.
And so what I tend to do is that, and then have to do something else, or that whilst I'm doing something else. So whilst I was making The Infidel, I was writing this book, because on set there's loads and loads of time where you're just doing nothing. But I think my novels would be better. I think, who is the American fiction writer who wrote that On Writing book that's a kind of nuts and bolts guide to writing?
Stephen King.
Yeah, Stephen King. Have you read that?
Yeah.
He says you should write the first 6 months with the door shut.
Yeah.
Like you should do nothing else and not show it to anyone or whatever. I've never done that.
Right. So you're showing it as you go along.
Well, I sort of talk about it to people, and you know, I do it all wrong.
This is a sort of slightly lighthearted question, but I was very interested about whether there was any real life kind of inspiration in the running joke about Chris Noth, Mr. Big from Sex and the City,
yes,
and Peter Florick in The Good Life.
It
felt personal in some way. I wondered why you
chose him. Is he in The Good Wife?
Yeah.
Because, of course, Eli Gold is a character in The Good Wife, but I didn't know that when I started. That's really annoying that people always ask me, is it that Alan Cumming's character? There's no real life inspiration except purely that. I've for many years thought that Chris Noth is a strange name, and everyone must think, well, is it North? Is it Moth? It can't be Noth. That's a really weird name. So I purely had Harvey write one of his celebrity biographies about him to get that gag in.
My wife was having some dealings with Chris Noth on the phone while I was reading the book, so but I didn't tell him. You're all right. You're safe.
Yeah. That's good.
It's emphasised several times in the novel that you want to separate the author and their characters. That's something that seems very important.
Yeah.
Is that a message to the reader of the novel as well as working inside the book?
Well, more important to me than separating the author and the characters is there's a bit where, well, you know, it's as ever, I try and qualify it and cover it with irony and comedy a bit, but there's a bit where Harvey is, he spends a lot of time looking at Eli's stuff and looking at videos of Eli on YouTube, but then he does a thing which all authors do, which is to look at his own book on Amazon and then be depressed at how little it's selling and how bad the reviews are, and then looks at a good review, and of course it's written by him. But then one of the things that annoys him is that other people who have been doing it down say that they don't like the characters in his book, and he does a whole rant about you're not supposed to like people in literature, who likes Humbert, you know, who likes Raskolnikov or whatever, and then but then he's depressed because the character is in fact entirely based on himself. But I do believe that very strongly. I think one of the things that is problematic about the way that people perceive literature now is, like, do I like the people in this book? And I kind of think that is not the way forward, because in life there's lots of people you don't like, but you should still be able to think about them and express stuff about them.
I had to read the book at speed for today, so I apologise if I missed something here. But one of the big things that struck me as a very interesting scene, but I didn't really understand it, was why Bunce sent the child pornography to Harvey.
Well, I think Bunce is supposed to represent some kind of extremity of masculinity for me. The book is, I guess, probably... Well, it's about greatness and about masculinity. And masculinity and what it might become and its the trouble with it at the present time is a big issue with it. And Bunce is a kind of, he is a grotesque version of what a male can be, but at the same time, because I like to keep the book kind of keeping the reader guessing, he's very bright,
he's
got married, which people don't expect, and he does think about the fact that he's in sex crime, that's what he's in, and he's based on someone I know who in that, and he and then when he does that, it's meant to be to some extent about that going too far.
Right.
It's about someone who doesn't realise how much sort of being that male can lead you into a sort of not understanding where the boundary is of what, you know.
But what does he want Harvey to, why does he do it?
He does it literally because he wants Harvey to kind of be understanding of his world at some level.
Okay.
At some level, Bunce does it because, you know, he just thinks, okay, you want to know about my world, this is my world.
Right.
I also, another thing, I guess, and I sort of meta level, for want of a better word, just thought, I see no reason why you can't make comedy out of this.
Right.
And it is, people have told me it's a funny scene, and I think because it involves something it's an absolute total folk devil of our lives, and yet it's a comic scene, for me it's a challenge as a writer to make a comic scene out of that.
You mentioned also about the Amazon reviews, and that's it, as you say, that's every writer does. It's every writer's worst fear, the bad Amazon reviews. What inspired this section? And have you ever been tempted to write your own reviews on Amazon?
I've certainly been tempted. I never have done. I think one of the things about being well-known for other things is that you have to watch yourself with that kind of behaviour, as as everyone will know. I've certainly been tempted. I haven't done it. I know... thing Orlando Figuez did it, didn't he? And I met him the other day. He's a lovely, lovely bloke, and I felt like it's really unfair that he's probably a great historian, but that's what he's going to be thought about when people meet him. He was that bloke. That's what I thought about. So it's a bad thing to do. But I mean, I think also one of the things about being known as a person beyond your writing is that you notice every so often that you will get a review that's clearly about you rather than them, either on Amazon or indeed elsewhere. My previous novel, which is called The Secret Purposes, which is a historical novel set on the Isle of Man during the Second World War, I remember reading an article by her. This must be subconscious. It's by his mum, who was called Eva Figueres. It was the review in The Guardian. And I remember reading it thinking, it's a nice review, but the thing I really loved about it is I don't think she knew that I was on telly.
Right, right.
And it was the first ever kind of review I'd ever got that didn't either way, positive or negatively, talk about my other career in terms of this book. And then separate to that, there was a bad review of that book by Norman Lebrecht, which clearly he kind of liked the book, but he just said, I cannot forgive David Baddiel. Or does David Baddiel think we're going to forget that he's on television drinking beer and talking about football? And I kind of think, well, it's not relevant for me that I do that, because the book isn't that. But clearly it's very hard for some people to get that out of their head. So I think in terms of my particular experience is that sometimes I read those reviews and think it's me they're reviewing, really, not the book.
But is your work in various fields, is it aimed at the same people, or is there a different, do you feel that you're addressing the same people on TV that you are when you write a novel?
I feel that I am not addressing anyone. All I ever do, both in comedy and in the books and whatever I do, is I try and write what I want to write about, and it is just true. And actually, I'm trying to do a stand-up show about this now. It's a sort of about fame, but it's also about complexity. It's about the complexity of my own personality, but of everyone's personality, that gets reduced when you're famous, which the book is a bit about. Eli says this thing. He says fame is like starlight, by which he doesn't mean that it's glittering and beautiful, but that whatever, it's like when you see stars, it's the light from long ago. Whenever you see a famous person, it's kind of what you thought about when you first made up your mind about them. And similarly, I think that when I try and do something, it is really just me expressing my own interest or complexity and whatever. But some people clearly feel, okay, well, the football stuff, that's for this audience, and the novels, it's not. That's just me. I like football and I like novels, so I'm going to do both.
Okay, this is the last question. I read in the Evening Standard, so it doesn't necessarily mean that it's true, but that you're consciously trying to lower your profile.
Well, that's from that interesting thing. That's a great example, because the show is also partly about the misrepresentations and the way that meaning slips when you're famous, so your public utterances become all confused. And that was from, I did this 5x15 thing at the Tabernacle, but it's towards a show that I want to do, deconstructing my own fame and what it's like to be famous and answering some of the questions about sort of fame. Like, for example, I talk about how I'm not as famous as I used to be, and that's a taboo, I think, for a famous person to do. It's very unusual to do that, but I do it because it leads to some interesting and I hope funny deconstructions about fame. But then when it's reproduced in a newspaper, it just looks like a sort of strange, whinging, self-pitying remark.
Right.
And it isn't, if you see it in context of this whole show. So,
but that is a deliberate decision that was.
What happened in 2006 when Baddiel and Skinner Unplanned stopped. I decided, because I was offered another thing then, and I do get offered. I get offered a lot of rubbish on TV, and I could be on TV all the time doing rubbish, but I don't want to do that. But also, more importantly, I do want to write books and I do want to make films, and I just don't have time to do lots of TV. But also, I guess, at some level, I have resigned myself to the defeat, I guess, that if you are on TV all the time, it is almost impossible for the expression of your work in other areas to kind of be taken as it should be.
Sure.
So that's kind of what I'm doing, is hoping to carve out a silent space in which it can be.
Thank you very much, David Baddiel.
Thank you very much. It was great.
You're listening to Fiction Uncovered. Great writing to discover.